The very first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:1, is, I believe, the most important, informative, and elegant sentence that has ever been written in any language at any time. It's composed of seven Hebrew words: Bereshit bara Elohim hashmayim v'et ha'aretz. Seven words. The English translation we all know: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, there's an amazing amount of vital information in these first seven Bible words. From its starting point, from the very beginning, Scripture deals with our most basic questions about our being and existence. Haven't we all asked at some point in our life, does God exist? How did the universe begin? When did it begin? How long have people been on earth? Is there a purpose for human life? And if there is, what is that purpose? What is my purpose? Why are we here? How did we get here? There are many questions. We could spend a long time making a list of questions that you have asked yourself and the people ask about the very meaning of existence, the human existence, about this universe. The most basic questions we could ask concerning all creation are addressed and answered in the opening few chapters of the book of Genesis, beginning with this one sentence of seven Hebrew words. Now, when I say the most basic questions we have can be answered in one verse, many people, including some who attend church services every week, would smile at my naivete and ignorance. Anybody who knew I held such a belief would say, poor child, he's 3 bricks short of a full load. How could anyone believe that those things are answered in this one Bible verse? Such an unsophisticated idea that I would think and actually believe that the answers to difficult and deep questions that have troubled humanity from the very beginning could actually be found and answered in the Bible at all, let alone in the very first verse of the book of Genesis. Well, that's ridiculous. That's childish. That's an ignorant idea. The questions that I asked are for the learned, for those who are educated, for the scientists, the scholars, and the deep thinkers. They're the ones that can answer those questions. They are beyond anything that could be found in an ancient writing such as the Bible. After all, we all have one. How could it tell us anything about those important issues? Now, it's a concept that I'm not thinking about as I'm walking down the street or involving myself in affairs of life or as I've been working or whatever I'm doing. But the reality is, for most people, God is really not the creator of the universe or of human life. The fact that we're here is really the result of unthinking, mindless, natural processes at work. It really has nothing whatever to do with God. So that kind of molds their thinking of most people. They just go along. I mean, they're atheistic, they're agnostic. It's just not a part of their life or their thinking. So just for a few moments before getting into the answers that we can find from Genesis 1 verse 1, I'd like to take a look at the opinions of people concerning whether or not God is indeed the creator. So the information I learned from a Wikipedia article entitled Level of Support for Evolution, it discusses the ideas that people have regarding our human existence. And from this article I learned that nearly every scientific society representing hundreds of thousands of scientists has issued statements rejecting intelligent design. Now, that's kind of interesting. So when you talk about what scientists believe, the vast majority of them do not believe that God is creator. A petition supporting the teaching of evolutionary biology was endorsed by 72 U.S. Nobel Prize winners. The very cream of the cream, the best of the best, believe that somehow we are the product only of evolution, not by divine creation. U.S. courts have ruled in favor concerning the teaching of evolution in science classrooms, and they have ruled against the teaching of creationism in numerous cases. If you believe in creation as opposed to evolution, in the world in which we live, you're kind of ignorant. You're kind of an annoying person. A 1995 Gallup poll found that about 5% of American scientists identified themselves as creationists. That's only 1 out of 20. Only 5% of scientists believe in creation. Now, that's rather strong evidence. That's a lot of force to fight against. To say that you believe that God is creator puts you in a little basket of a minority of people. Now, 480,000 United States Earth and life scientists in 1987 were polled as to their belief on creation. So that's nearly 500,000, 480 men and women in our country who work in earth and life sciences. They were asked about what their belief was regarding creationism, that God indeed was the creator. Of that 480,000 men and women who expressed their opinion whether or not God actually is a creator, only 700 said that he was. That's just about only 1 out of every 700 scientists in the earth and life science in the United States believe in creationism. So as I said, I'm not thinking about that information as I'm conducting my life, but maybe I need to think about it more and more, that the people I deal with don't have, for the most part, the same viewpoint, the same belief, the same understanding that I do. Now, in the United States, another poll was taken to see the percentage of those who agree that evolution is the best explanation for life on Earth. So now we're being asked, what do you think is the reason for life on Earth? And so this one particular study is broken down based on various faiths. So the percentage of American Buddhists who believe that evolution is the best explanation for life on Earth comes in at, are you thinking of a number? What percentage of Buddhists believe in evolution as opposed to creation? You've got a number, right? If I were you, I'd have a number. I've got one right here. 81%. 4 out of 5 Buddhists believe in evolution and not creation. Those of the Jewish faith come in not far behind. 77% of those of the Jewish faith believe in evolution as opposed to creation, which is to me very remarkable, since they were the ones that the Bible was written, the Old Testament at least, in their language. You know, many of them can read it without translation. They have the book. But yet 3 out of 4 are believers in evolution. Catholics, it came out that 58% believed in the evolutionary creation. When it came to mainline Protestants, the number was 51%. Of the total United States population, 48% believe evolution is the best explanation for the origin of human life on Earth. Just about half of the people in our country do not believe that God is our creator. Another poll, a May 2012 poll, Gallup poll, surveyed Americans whether they believe that God created human beings in our present form at some point within the last 10,000 years. So that poll didn't limit it just to 7,000. They said, did God in the last 10,000 years create us as we are today? Now, the results that they took were based on levels of education, of formal education. And what the survey revealed is rather interesting, and that is that the more education, the more formal education people have, the less likely they are to believe that God is indeed the creator. Those who have a high school education or less, 52% believe that we're here because God created us. With those who are college graduates, the number drops to 46%. For those who have a postgraduate education, it's only 25%. So if you're a high school graduate, you're twice as likely to believe that we're here by creation, by God's design, than if you are a postgraduate individual. Now, as startling as that information is, at least it was to me to uncover it, the belief in evolution is less accepted in the United States than it is in most countries of the world. It's 80% or very close to it who believe that life was here because of an evolutionary process and not by creation. In countries such as Iceland, Denmark, Sweden, France, Japan, the United Kingdom, and Norway. 4 out of 5 in those countries don't believe that God's their creator. It's 70% in Spain, Germany, Italy, and Ireland who don't believe that we're here by God's design and creation. Of the countries surveyed, there was only one that had a lower percentage belief in creation by evolution than the United States. And that was, I imagine, it probably would be here for hours and before anybody would guess that country. Only one country, the ones that were surveyed, are less likely to believe in evolution than we are in America, and that is Turkey. In Turkey, it's only 25% who believe that we're here by evolution. The rest of it have an idea of creation. Now, in Genesis 1:1, where God sets forth to explain answers to questions that we have about our creation, in all parts of our life, and even ultimately eternal life, this is an answer and an explanation given by the one that did the creating. So to reject his statements is what is rather ludicrous and laughable as far as I'm concerned, not the reverse. Now, you may wonder, how could I believe that? You know, it's just there. 7 words, and of course the first few chapters are involved in the whole process as well. How could it be? Well, look at it this way. The knowledge that God gives us about our origins, our purpose, our explanation for being here, is a lot like the letter, which is the subject of Edgar Allan Poe's short story that he wrote in 1845 called The Purloined Letter. Has anybody here read The Purloined Letter? Any hands? No hands? Well, Edgar Allan Poe was, of course, a master of the short story. And the subject of The Purloined Letter is a very incriminating letter, very important letter, which was lost or not found. And so it was thought to be in this one particular room. The police came in and searched the room, even poking needles into the upholstery of the furniture, looking for the letter. And it was not found. Somebody else walked into the room, looked, and there it was, in plain sight. A letter that was examined for very carefully was not found, although it was in plain sight. Let's go forward another century. Has anybody seen the movie Gaslight? Okay. Just one, two. Raise your hand. I mean, I like to know. I mean, you know, you're not going to be accused of being moviegoers in excess. Now, I saw that movie, too. Has it been colorized? I saw it in black and white. So I don't know whether it's been colorized or not. But the movie Gaslight was very interesting. It's a 1944 movie. It stars Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer. And what you may or may not know, even if you watch it, it was Angela Lansbury's introduction to the screen. That was her first movie, Angela Lansbury. And Murder, She Wrote, you know. That was her very first gig, 1944. Now, the subject of the movie is a fascinating study. If you haven't seen it and you don't mind black and white, I'd say see the movie. The idea is that Charles Boyer is a villain and a jewel thief and a murderer. So he murders for the jewels, but was not able to take them with him, not able to get them, committed murder for them, wasn't able to get them. And so he married the lady, contrived to marry the lady, that was in possession of the house in which these jewels were located. And then spent months, if not years, searching for them, driving Ingrid Bergman slowly to the point of madness in the process, attempting to find the location of these very precious jewels, which were, in the end, hidden in plain sight. Now, the idea of being hidden in plain sight is something we see from time to time. Have you ever watched the Antique Roadshow, where people have brought items to the appraisers and the experts to evaluate how valuable they are? And every now and again, someone is found to have a very precious ceramic item of furniture, perhaps ugly painting on a wall somewhere, which is found to be of something of great value. Wealth, value, hidden in plain sight. Or a valuable baseball card. One place where I was working some years ago, a man came in who had gone to a bookstore, thumbing through old Bibles, discovered in the middle of the Bible an extremely valuable baseball card, first edition. There it was, right there in the Bible, maybe serving as a bookmark for many years, or maybe in a book that wasn't being read for many years. But that one card bought him a house, exchanged that one card for a house on Lookout Mountain. That was his ticket to a home. Something of great value hidden in plain sight. And so I'd like to suggest that the answers to the most basic questions we could have for thousands of years has remained hidden in plain sight for the view of most people in the opening verse and chapters of the book of Genesis. Now, when we have questions, there are six words we use in the English language when we ask questions. And they're called interrogative words, interrogative. Words that, when spoken, call for an answer. Words that ask for information. Most, but not all of them, begin with WH. We know that. Who, what, where, when, why. And then the sixth interrogative word, how. These are the words we use when we want to know something. These are the words that form the question mark at the end of a sentence. The surprised wife asks her husband, "Who's coming to dinner?" The man without a watch asks his co-worker, "What time is it?" The cab driver asks his fare, "Where do you want to go?" The student asks the teacher, "When Do you want this assignment in? The small child asks his parent, why do I have to go to bed now? And someone observing a friend doing a slick card trick asks, how did you do that? We want to know something, we use these words. Who, what, where, when, why, and how. These are the words we all use when we want to find things out. So doesn't it make sense that God, who created all things, would begin his revelation to mankind by answering these most basic questions his human readers would have in the opening verse of the revelation? Don't you think it might be the case that the answers to the questions we all have all along been there, hidden in plain sight? He knows we have these questions and begins his revelation to us by answering them from the very start. In a most succinct manner possible, a single sentence, a succinct statement of seven clear, unambiguous, and powerful words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Let's take a look today at the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, because Genesis does mean beginnings, and especially this first verse to examine how many of our most important questions of creation, our human existence, receive an answer direct from God in the beginning of his pages of revelation to us. So the first phrase, in the beginning. Now, when you just stop and look at it and think about it for what it is, and kind of back off from our excessive familiarity sometimes with the Bible, sometimes something is so close to you, you fail to appreciate its awe. But when God decided to speak to us, he began with a bold, eye-popping, powerful word, which in Hebrew, Bereshit, means in beginning, or implied the word the beginning, or the. In the beginning. So what is being told to us from the very first word of the Bible is powerful, it's direct. And God is saying in the book of Genesis, this is not a fairy tale. This is not a once upon a time story. Or long ago and far away in a strange and distant land kind of story. Or my favorite, it was on a dark and stormy night type of story. We know those are stories. You know, those are stories. Those are man-made stories. But God isn't dealing with stories. It's a powerful, direct, declamatory statement. This is the way it was. This is when it was. It's in the beginning. It's going to be a recital of important events that God initiated in our behalf. When we read Genesis 1, we need to realize what it is. It is not the Hebrew creation story. It is not the Hebrew creation myth. Perhaps taken in part from an earlier Babylonian or Egyptian myth, passed on from generation to generation of Hebrew children by their parents to explain to them these unanswerable questions. I know that idea has been put forward. You know, all the Egyptians had these ideas. The Babylonians had these ideas. The Hebrews borrowed from them. No, that's not the way it was. The answers to the questions of where, when, why, how, and what are directly from God. And they are answers that no philosopher, thinker, scientist could ever give. They could not answer the questions with Genesis 1:1 asks. Now, why can't man answer these questions? Because the information you receive from Genesis 1:1 is information that could only be known by God, the Creator, in the first place. One who existed before there was time. Only God, who managed all, can give the answer that is correct and true to our questions. And he starts explaining to us by the ultimate starting point, which is in the beginning. The first word, there is sheet. Scripture tells us that the universe had not eternally existed. It has had a beginning. In the beginning. Well, that gives us an answer right there. For a long time, scientists have held kind of like the steady state theory, the universe always existed, maybe shrinking, maybe expanding. You know, it's always been here. Well, that's an idea that has been held, and maybe some still do that. But the very first verse of the Bible says that the universe had a beginning. Now, science cannot tell us how the universe came about. It's beyond the ability, the capability of science to know what happened in the beginning when God created the heaven and earth. It just cannot be known. They can't answer that question. Now, today, the most accepted viewpoint of creation is what's called the Big Bang Theory, the prevailing cosmological model that describes the early development of the universe. And it states that the bang occurred approximately 13.8 billion years ago, give or take a few hundred million. And who knows? That may be true. Now, since I was in school a little over 50 years ago in high school, I remember that in our science class then, we were taught the universe was about 3 billion years old. Now, that's what they believed then. Now today, 50 years later, I'm 50 years older, but the universe is 10 billion years older. It's aged a whole lot faster than I have. So we don't know for sure whether that's going to be the last number they ever come up with for the age of the universe, but they're thinking with their tools that maybe it's that old, that it had a beginning point. Now I'd like to give you a quote from the Wikipedia article on Big Bang. When you're beginning to think that the science are able to explain ultimate origins, the Wikipedia, which is a respected source, points this out. The Big Bang Theory does not provide any explanation for the initial conditions of the universe. Rather, it describes the general evolution of the universe going forward from that time on. So what that's really saying is that no matter how long science studies, you know, when it began, Big Bang, or exactly how that mechanism took place, they can't tell you anything about the origin. They can only tell you or attempt to explain what happened after that origin has occurred. So that information, as far as the creation and the origin, is something that the Creator alone has the ability to reveal, and that He has in His Word. So science has limitations indeed. It can study matter and energy, but cannot speak to the time before matter and energy existed. That knowledge is the sole providence of God Himself. And we can know only what He chooses to share with us in His revealed Word. The creation of Genesis, the first few chapters, stands out from all other attempts of literature to explain what creation is, to answer the who, where, when, why, what, and how of it. Now, many peoples, many societies have a creation story, a myth, about the origins of the world, about the origins of human life and the universe. Now, some of these stories go back a long way in antiquity and have been repeated generation after generation, where humans attempt to give sense and meaning to what they do not know. Some of them are ancient, such as the Babylonian, Mesopotamian creation myth. Now, I won't bore you with much of it, but here are a few lines of it and see if you get any sense of real meaning from this. And this is from the Mesopotamian Babylonian creation myth. When on high the heaven had not been named, firm ground below had not been called by name, when primordial Apsu, their begetter, and Mumu Tiamat, she who bare them all, Their waters mingled as a single body. No reed hut had sprung forth. No marshland had appeared. None of the gods had been brought into being. And none had a name and no destinies determined. That it was that the gods were formed in the middle of heaven. Lamu and Lahamu were brought forth. By name they were called. Now, it just keeps going after that. But that's more than enough to bore you. There's no explanation there. There's no understanding there. There's no answer to questions there. Then there's a Chinese creation myth. And their myth is like this. In the beginning, that's a good word to start with, the heavens and earth were still one and all was chaos. It's a measure of understanding here. The universe was like a big black egg, carrying Pan goo inside itself. After 18,000 years, Pan goo awoke from a long sleep. He felt suffocated, so he took a broad axe and wielded it with all his might to crack open the egg. The light clear part of it floated up and formed the heavens. The cold turbid matter stayed below to form Earth. Pan goo stood in the middle, his head touching the sky, his feet planted on the earth. The heaven and the earth began to grow at the rate of 10 feet per day. And Pan goo grew along with them. After another 18,000 years, the sky was higher, the earth thicker, and Pan goo stood between them like a pillar, 9 million li, whatever a li is, in height, so they would never join again. When Pan goo died, his breath became the wind and clouds, his voice the rolling thunder. And of course, it continues to go on from there. Now, that's quite a story, but there's no truth in it. There's no truth in any of these. They just don't know. So back to Genesis 1:1, where we begin to learn what really happened at creation. So the word "in the beginning" tells us when the creation of this physical universe took place and that it did not always exist. So that's, I think, something we can nail down. It didn't always exist. It began the physical world, the universe, in the beginning. Now, the next word is, well, the third word in Hebrew, but the next word in the English language is God. So first of all, we had the when, now we have the who. God did the creating. An interesting word, Elohim did the creating. Now, we just look at it in English and read, in the beginning, God. But because it's a translation from another language, there's something that we happen to miss. And that is the word Elohim is a plural word, not singular. The singular word is Eloah, and it means a deity, or perhaps the deity, God. So the word God could be expressed by Eloah. But the startling revelation of the very second word in the English version is that God is introduced with a plural word, Elohim. Now, throughout this chapter, starting with verse 3, Genesis 1, verse 3, you'll see many times that Elohim is either speaking or some kind of action. You read in verse 3, God said, and something happened. Verse 5, God called, and something happened. Verse 6, God said. Verse 7, God made. Verse 8, God called. Verse 9, God said. Verse 10, God called. So here you have God taking all kinds of actions, speaking, taking action. Verse 17, God placed things in the expanse. So here we have in verse 21, God created. So here we have the who, God, taking all courses of action, speaking, bringing things about in the creation. And then we come down to an amazing verse, and that's verse 26, which is really a stumbling block to many in their understanding of God. Because here we have something which is, again, an eye-popping expression. And God said, let us make man in our image. So here we have Elohim speaking to Elohim. Let us make man in our image. Now, some people might try to explain it, well, this is the formal I. Instead of saying, I'm going to the store, you might say, well, we're going to the store. You know, some uppity person say that. But here we have, as we'll find later on as we get more into this study, it's very plain. We're having a communication between two individuals who are equal, who are of the same substance, who are there from the very beginning, who are God. And that's a remarkable concept. An amazing truth that God spoke with God. And throughout all the chapter of Genesis 1, again, it's a remarkable truth, shall I say, hidden in plain sight, that begins to tell us a little bit about the nature of God. Something remarkable, an unimagined reality about the unity and plurality of God, the sovereign of the universe. The actual nature of God, what it means that God can say, let us make man in our image and not my image, according to our likeness, not my likeness, is unlike any concept of any religion or any faith that I'm familiar with. A statement like this can be made by God. Now, the exact relationship in this unity is not clearly revealed in the Old Testament. It's stated, it's spoken, but it waits for the New Testament for a full revelation of just exactly what this means. The Hebrews understood that the Bible teaches a monotheistic God, that there's only one God, not a plurality of gods, only one. We're familiar with Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, where it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Now that is a clarion call of faith and monotheism that has been understood. And here is where the tripping point takes place. When Jesus Christ came to earth in human form as a Son of God, because of the darkness of their understanding, it was impossible for the religious of his day to accept him as being from God because of their incorrect understanding of the nature of God. They did not understand what Genesis 1 verse 26 was telling them about God. Let us make man in our image. So in Genesis 1:1, we see that in the beginning tells us when. The word Elohim tells us who did the creating. Genesis 1 verse 26 begins to throw a whole lot more information into that word, what it means that God did the creating. And in fact, when I prepared this message, I really planned to go through that with you. I have many more pages of notes that I wanted to share with you. But since I never know exactly how long I'm going to speak at any given time I speak, I really think it'd be well worth our while to take a bit more time and not to try to rush through that very second word, God, Elohim, to really understand the relationship of God the Father and Jesus Christ from the very beginning, to know the answer to the question, who of the book of Genesis? So I'd like to reserve then for next time that I speak to cover in detail that and the other questions, the what, when, how, and why that are answered in Genesis 1 and the very next few chapters. To look more into the matter of answers from the book of Genesis, especially Genesis 1:1, to study and to explore the truth of God revealed to us in plain sight.